Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
May it please the court, Amjad Khan for the appellants in this matter. I will endeavor to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is a de novo review of a 12B6 dismissal. Every well-pleaded allegation is taken as true. Now, our clients have already cleared the highest bars in federal securities litigation. The district court found, and defendants do not contest on this appeal, that the third amended complaint adequately pleads material misrepresentations and omissions, three of them to be precise, each identified with particularity. It's already found scienter, including deliberate recklessness supported by defendants' own written admissions. It's already found reliance and the
right,
connection.
So let's get to the point of this case. What about economic loss? That's
yes.
Basically what this case turns on, whether or not your clients alleged an economic loss.
Yes, Your Honor. And in every publicly traded securities case, economic loss is straightforward. You show the stock price differential and the decline. You compare the inflated price that was paid during the fraud to the depressed price after the truth comes out in light of the misrepresentations. And usually that's achieved through a corrective disclosure or fraud on the market. But so if there's a differential, there's a loss. The district court's ruling is fundamentally at odds with that traditional definition. That's how the vast majority of securities cases work. But it shouldn't be.
But it turns on the nature of what a safe note is.
Yes, exactly. And in this context, I want to turn to defendant's supplemental brief in particular, because that, I think, really the concessions in there are significant. Defendants expressly concede on page 5 that the value of the safe notes can be valued. They simply contend that the only relevant valuation is the purchase price at the time of the transaction. So there's no dispute that safes are capable of valuation upon conversion, and defendant's sole disagreement is only over when and how the valuation should occur. Our contention, and we've set forth in pretty significant detail in our supplemental brief, that we have set forth methodology that will very clearly define how you measure that present decline in value. And historical cost is not present value. That's the flaw in the argument raised in the supplemental brief. The defendants themselves acknowledge that the safe's economic return depends on multiple contingent outcomes. And once those probabilities change because of concealed fraud, the expected value of the contractual right changes as well. That is the economic loss we allege. The district court dismissed only because it imposed an additional requirement that the plaintiffs plead the impossibility of conversion. But a safe is not, you know, a safe is not merely a hope of a future conversion. If you think about our clients, the investors, what's the pot at the end of the rainbow? It's equity, because it's a simple agreement for future equity, but it's also significantly the enterprise value of the issuing party, which is the company. So it's significant to, and it's ignored in the defendant's briefing, just like an option, just like a warrant. There's clear methodology, the option price method particularly, that factors in the enterprise value of the company. So it's a simple analysis to determine, well, there are fixed terms that are in the actual Y Combinator note, but there are variables. And those variables and contingencies are not just the triggering events. The most important variable, by far and away, is what's the company worth? What's the valuation of the company? And we believe we can support that.
And so what is the company now worthless?
So this is the, Judge Wardlaw, you ask a very important question for one important reason, which is we don't have inspection rights as a safe note holder, unlike a stockholder. So we don't know. That's the honest answer to your question. We don't know. We have significant indicia and an expectation that the company is nearing worthlessness, but we have no way of knowing that. We don't have the books and records. We don't have the ability to test that. What we do have is some admissions that we cite from some of the pleadings that investments are lacking, that investments are sorely needed. And it's been 5 years, and there hasn't been any indication, at least in the public arena, that this company is worth anything. And I think this standard of impossibility is cannot be the standard in a private security if it's not the standard in a public security. You wouldn't be asking, well, is the company changing, suddenly having an improvement in its valuation after the stock price decline? No, you just have to show present decline in value. That's literally what Dura says. That's what In Re Dow says. That's what all the cases said. But and the district court got it right by actually identifying the misrepresentations and the omissions, but then somehow imposed a standard that's, I would argue, impossible for the investors to achieve. Why should we have to show worthlessness? We just have to show a diminishment of value. We've pled that in paragraph 40 and 141 of our third amended complaint very clearly, a diminishment of value. And the OPM method that we put forth and the PWERM methods, I should add, these are safe note valuation methods, meaning the accounting associations have determined. I didn't see any Amici brief submitted, but from our vantage point, based on our extensive look at this, and it is a novel area, what's not novel is valuing these instruments. It's done. And safe notes are valued.
Let me interrupt you because I have a question. So let's pretend I'm a safe investor. Is my only ability to recover when the shares are actually issued? Am I able to sell my safe investment, my safes, for lack of a better term, before there's a conversion?
Not in this context, because it's a non-transferable note in the actual specific terms of the safe, the Y Combinator note. If you look at the record that we cite that in our supplemental brief. So we don't have the ability to change it. All we have the ability to do is value it. And we value it in two ways, as I've described. The traditional way, of course, is to look at the present decline, which, of course, an expert, and we have an expert that will go through this process. It's very technical, but it would determine, okay, it's not just the triggering events. It's there were misrepresentations. Those and those omissions bespeak to the core harm that and the core fraud that the court articulated. And I want to mention this specifically because it's important. The district court actually rightly identifies the core fraud as the material omission that defendants were soliciting the funds to benefit themselves and to grow the value of Kobe Kavalan's shares in the parent company AI Visualize, not to benefit LifeVoxel or its shareholders through the implementation of the action plan. That's a district court's characterization and recognition of the core fraud. And then, of course, there are specific omissions and misrepresentations, which are very clear. So if those were not made, and if actually there wasn't self-enrichment here, and Mr. Kavalan didn't actually buy back the very shares that he bought out of the parent company into his own LLC, obviously there would be more value to the note, number one. And number two, what is the company's worth now? That's what the option price method factors in. Those are the inputs you put in. And then it would spit out a present decline in value, the very same way a federal securities case in the public sector you can do in the private sector. It's achievable in the safe notes context. It just hasn't been done yet because this is a case of first impression with the safe, but there's no reason it shouldn't be done.
Counsel, if I could jump in, I have two questions. They're on this very theme and they're very important to me. So first one is, if I hold safe notes, whatever you want to call them, I have safes and I'm married, and then I'm getting divorced, and they have to do a valuation of the estate for divorce purposes, it seems like they would have to be able to assign a value to those notes when they're trying to figure out how to divvy up the estate. Do you have any, in your experience, you have any instances, these tech people are getting divorced all the time. Do you have any examples of someone's estate, or even just someone who passes away who has safe notes, is going to be valued because the estate has to be divvied up among the children, let's say? Do you have any examples of the safe note actually being valued in that context?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask, Judge Owens, and it's a very important question. The answer is, of course, it can be valued, and of course, it must be valued. It's an asset, just like anything else, like a litigation claim, an option, a warrant. Assets are assets. They're subject to valuation. The examples that I have discussed with, and I want to be careful here because I don't want to go extra record. Sure. But I do want to mention that the expert that we spoke to, Matt Torum, in the supplemental brief, he has a whole article on valuations of safes. And in the course of understanding this admittedly very technical area, he said he values safes for clients all the time. When there's material changes in his clients, which are investors, in their lives, and then he ascribes a value to them. So we will be able to show that. It happens all the time on the open market. And that's all we need to show, especially in a case where we're on the 2-yard line. We have core frauds, omissions. No one's contesting them. The economic loss is just in the private context. And I think we've pled that pretty substantially. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. Let me ask you the second question I have is that I think you're seeking leave to amend as a possible out in this case. If you were to amend on the issue of economic loss, what would you add to the current Third Amendment complaint? What would be the extra thing?
Yes. So, of course, we would like there to be a reversal just consistent with the rule, sure. But you asked a specific question, so I'll give the specific answer. Number one, I would plead the valuation mechanics and the quantified diminution. Basically, I would allege the present value of the safe at purchase versus its value as impaired by the misrepresentation using the OMP Black-Scholes or the P-Worm methodologies, and then the safe zone fixed inputs and the $60 million post-money cap, the 80% discount, the defined triggers. And this is important to state a measurable decline in value rather than the binary loss that the district court did. Number two, and I want to make one point here very, very clearly. According to what I would plead if we were given leave to amend, if in my estimation, and I wanted to give an analogy so that this could, you know, so each of the three misrepresentations maps directly to the valuation formula. This is what I would plead, Judge Owens. If the investment funds were not used for the intended purpose to grow Lifeoxyl, the enterprise, Lifeoxyl, has less capital. That can be valued. If the Voxel Cloud contracts weren't fully transferred, 20% were not transferred to Lifeoxyl as intended, the enterprise has less revenue, that can be valued. I would plead that. If there are undisclosed equity holders in Lifeoxyl, as there were, the per share value on conversion is reduced, that can be valued. Every misrepresentation factors into the inputs that OPM and PWORM use to calculate present value. I would just make that clear. I don't think we need to because it's so technical. I mean, that requires expert testimony. We've pled diminishment. I think that's all you need to do. But if we were given leave, we would surely do that. I mean, we didn't get an opportunity to.
Right. So some of the themes that were brought up in supplemental briefing, in fact, would essentially be put into a Fourth Amendment complaint.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Do you want to reserve your time?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Judge Wortel. Okay,
thank you. Mr. Sargent?
Yes, good morning. May it please the court. Of course, I have an outline prepared, but based on the earlier questions, I'm going to deviate somewhat. With respect to the claim of worthless, that was the claim in the third amended complaint, in the original complaint, first amended, second complaint, that the loss occurred at the time of the transaction. And that's alleged in, paragraph 39 and 175. So with respect to the district court's holding, the district court was looking at the economic loss theory advanced by the plaintiffs. And that showed up also on page 45 of the brief, that the loss occurred at the time of the transaction. So analysis with respect to going forward years down the road as a valuation of a safe note may rise, wax and wane, depending on its the economic status at the time, is completely irrelevant.
I understood the district court's rationale to be that there was no way to measure the present value of a safe note. And we now have two ways that the present value of a safe note can be measured. Shouldn't we just let them have leave to amend and put forth that to the judge?
No, Your Honor. With respect to the district court's holding, now, of course, and he did go through a thorough analysis of the uniqueness of a safe note, but that was based upon the allegations in this complaint. So, for instance, there is an I don't dispute that there are other situations where you can have an economic loss and loss causation with safe notes, but that isn't what was pled here. What was pled here was that their loss was complete worthlessness. So that was the allegation. Taking that allegation and reading what a safe note does, that there's an opportunity for cash out conversion, equity inversion, and even a dissolution, where they would have a preference, a preferred recovery over the investors. So, for instance, if the company was dissolved and there was more than $3.5 million in intellectual property, their investment would be recovered. But you needed to know what took place at the time in order to have a determine what the economic loss is. They don't allege an economic loss here other than a complete loss. And then they have to connect the three misrepresentations to their theory of economic loss. And that's where they failed. From the first time I read the original complaint, you know, in this situation, they have, you know, the court listed the three misrepresentations: source of revenue, use, and alleged dilution. None of those relate to an ultimate complete loss of valuation. Now, there could be other factual scenarios where in a safe note, there could be misrepresentations that don't require that. Say, for instance, if we were to take the investments in Livit Holdings or WPP and insert a safe note, in those cases where there's a direct causation loss, if there are misrepresentations that directly lead to the bankruptcy or the demise of the company, and those facts are alleged, the plaintiff clearly can establish economic loss and loss causation. The problem here is that the plaintiff is now speaking metaphysically about safe notes, not in context of what they alleged. They alleged the loss was complete worthlessness and at the time of the transaction. One of the things, Your Honor, for instance, they alleged that he mentions that there's a diminution in value in paragraph 40. To be specific, Your Honor, paragraph 40 mentions that there's a diminution in value because one was delusion, which the court had mentioned is insufficient. And number two has to do with revenue received. Now, even if we were to take that allegation as true, later on in the complaint in paragraph 179, there's an allegation that even if, which I would equate to the exact opposite of but for, even if they fixed the delusion, even if the revenue came back in, their theory of loss causation was it was a complete loss because of the market is now aware of the situation. So the allegations of those three misrepresentations doesn't match up to their loss causation because there's no connection between those three allegations and the fact that they'll never receive achieve a conversion or an equity event or dissolution because of the market is now aware of the transaction. The problem here, Your Honor, is not that you can't value something later on. You clearly can. But the purpose of the Public Securities Reform Litigation Act is to not allow claims to get that far into discovery because of the public policy reasons. It should be quite simple to with a heightened level of standard that if there really was a misrepresentation, and it was material, it should not be, and the Dura court makes this quite clear, it should not be very difficult to allege what the economic loss and loss causation is. What's missing here in the plaintiff's complaint, which you see in all of the other private securities litigation claims, is, for instance, in Dura, they had the transaction loss was the actual purchase at an inflated price. The court said the problem was you didn't connect it down the road to a particular secondary related loss in market forces. And what they did there was they tried to combine transaction costs with alleged economic loss with respect to loss causation. In every case where there is a securities claim, you know, there's obviously going to be a transaction loss which took place on that day. But in all the other cases, there has to be a secondary related loss that occurs somewhere down the road. Now, unless, of course, the loss leads to the direct economic and loss causation, you know, such as Livit Holdings. So there are times that, and that's a direct causation. So in this case, and of course, you know, the case law is uniform that the plaintiff is, the defendant is entitled to know what their theory of economic loss is and what their theory of loss causation. You know, very often it's achieved through, a corrective disclosure or some sort of revelation. For instance, in the WPP Luxembourg, there was public became aware that the founders were doing a dump and pump, which made the loss inevitable. And there's also a revelation of a materialization of the risk. And neither one of those are the theories advanced by the plaintiff here. What the plaintiff advanced here was a direct causation that the ultimate loss, that the economic loss was a direct result of these three misrepresentations. And they don't connect the worthlessness to what the company is worth right now. I mean, the company is worth, it's not worthless, as they allege. I mean, it's worth, even a disillusion, they're going to have a recovery of their principal as long as the recovery is more than, the dissolved company has more than $3.5 million in assets. In other cases, Your Honor, and this is addressed in the McCabe case in the Third Circuit, where it describes how, which was a non-typical a public market case, where it describes the emerging case looking at the Suez equity case, which is the Second Circuit cases, where the court noticed that, mentioned that loss causation, transaction loss requires a second and related loss to lead to economic loss and a requirement to connect the economic loss with the underlying representations. In this case, there is no second loss. I mean, the company is still going forward. It is pure speculation at this point that the company can't ever convert or won't get equity. And it could, but that is what they claimed. Their theory of loss causation was that the loss occurred at the time. So the district court's holding with respect to impossibility of safe notes is based upon their claims. This is the claims here that because of their claim to worthlessness, they have to go forward. Their requirement was to allege that the three misrepresentations led to the worthlessness and there was a causation connection, approximate cause of the ultimate worthlessness. And again, Your Honor, to go back to, if we were to take the safe notes and put them into other non-typical cases where there has been found economic loss and loss causation, the plaintiffs would be able to meet those standards. But the issue here isn't what the issue here is what the plaintiffs pled. They pled there was a loss on that time, and the but-for cause was the representations. Now they're taking those allegations, and they're just combining those into satisfying the economic loss and the loss causation. Every other case that they've tried to do this, the courts have recognized that there's a difference between the but-for transaction loss, the economic loss, and the loss causation. And by claiming that the transaction led to the loss on the first day, and that based on a conclusion that is now worthless, they're combining the but-for cause, the transaction loss, with economic loss, with loss causation. For instance, in the Duveen court, the court recognized the plaintiff was advancing the same sort of an argument where there was a claim of transaction cost that they alleged led to an economic loss. But all they were doing was conflating. Thank you so much, Your Honor. I appreciate that. The theories with respect to economic loss and loss causation. I mean, from the beginning of this case, when I was trying to figure out with respect to their theory of their recovery, it appeared to be a direct causation theme. Now, of course, I do want to kind of mention, Your Honor, with respect to there is some changes in the third amended complaint where all of a sudden they seem to say that there's market forces that are aware of the losses. There is nothing in the public market. There's nothing in Exhibits K or L that are any way related to the allegations of the three allegations of the misrepresentations in the third amended complaint. If anything, Your Honor, is somewhat of it's a self-fulfilling prophecy or a bootstrap argument to say that subsequent litigation, including the arbitration claim, which was private, somehow caused a market revelation.
Let me ask you something, counsel. I'm just, this is in the context of securities fraud. I mean, the SEC has said this is a security. So if we were to uphold the district court's requirement that you must plead that the company's essentially worthless and a conversion event is not possible, wouldn't that, from a policy perspective, just be incentive for people to lie and make misrepresentations about the company that they're fundraising for, and know that they'll never have to make up for those misrepresentations because they can, with further, the company hasn't failed. It just seems to me that you shouldn't have to require a complete impossibility of conversion, or else you're going to incentivize this kind of alleged behavior, all these misrepresentations that are alleged, but which the district court found were pled sufficiently. And it would just reward people for lying to obtain, money for whatever, from unsuspecting investors.
If I would imagine in that situation, so if there was such claims, it would be very easy, as the Dura court mentioned, it shouldn't be that difficult to connect misrepresentations to a loss. For instance, if there was something along the lines of they just lied to people, took their money, and they never intended to go forward, that obviously is that is something that could be alleged, But in this case, and obviously that would be sort of like the Libid case where somebody did a transaction and it turned out it was fraudulent from the get-go and it had no viability, right away. So I think that is something that isn't necessarily a public policy reason. On the other hand, public policy was, if you allow a plaintiff to claim that a transaction loss constitutes economic loss and loss causation because there's a diminishment in value, that negates entirely. If you take the standard advanced by the plaintiffs, that would make loss causation, economic loss collapse all into transaction because
that's what we do with public equity, though. We look at a drop in stock value.
But that happens in non-typical cases, too, that there's a drop in value. In the Libid case, the WPP Luxembourg, that there was that's what I'm talking about, the secondary loss that was mentioned in the emergent case that out of the Suarez case and again described in McCabe, had a secondary related loss. And that's what the plaintiff is missing here. All of these securities cases have that secondary related loss that constitutes the economic loss and the loss causation. With only 30 seconds left, if you have any more questions, Your Honor, if not, I'm beyond my way. Thank you for your time and attention.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Khan.
I want to pick up Judge Wardlaw on your last point, because it's a significant point. What we're talking about here, and I'll address the allegations briefly in a moment, what we're talking about here is recourse for investors who have been defrauded. And what we haven't heard in these arguments are somehow this core fraud isn't specifically pled with exhaustive detail. What's omitted is all this discussion about the secret plan, which was self-evident. I mean, Mr. Kovalin saying, we need to buy back the AI, the parent company shares, but oh, by the way, my own LLC will buy them and I'll have 97%, 6.5% of the shares and LifeVox will get zero. I mean, that's the definition of a Ponzi scheme. We allege that in the complaint. So the idea that there's not going to be harm, we have to have an organizing principle here. The organizing principle is what Dura has said, what In Re Dao has said, which is the organizing principle is the present decline in value. And we have pled diminishment in paragraph 40 and 141. Mr. Sargent does not give credence to those allegations. ER 459, the value of the safe is materially less than presented to plaintiffs because of the dilution. Of course, we're actually pled diminishment in each of the misrepresentations. And now to this allegation point, our allegation is not that the safes were inevitably destined to become truly worthless. Our allegation is that at the time of the purchase, his clients concealed facts that substantially impaired the present economic value of the safe. That's the allegation. A safe is a contingent equity instrument. Its value depends on the issuer's prospect, the likelihood of the terms of the future conversion. It's the concealment, the concealed facts made that contingent claim materially less valuable. We should have our day in court and opportunity to prove that through our experts, as we've just described. The other point is I really am glad that Mr. Sargent has brought up these two cases. WPP Luxembourg, I just want to mention the specific pin site because it's very, very important. That claim, that case, Naveen and Livid are all helpful to our case. I want to read the standard because this is very important. And the exact pin site here is 1053, 655 Fed Third 1053 in WPP. In privately held companies, and this is our case, plaintiffs more commonly prove loss causation by showing that a misrepresentation or omission caused him or her to engage in a transaction and that the revelation of the truth, that's the phrase, very interesting phrase, revelation of the truth is directly related to the economic loss. The revelation of the truth is pled in maybe 40 paragraphs on the secret plan. The truth was revealed when Mr. Pooley was used as leverage and it was disclosed to him in an email that we quote from Covey saying he wants to capitalize on improving the vision of the parent company, not what he said in the restructuring resolution the past summer about Life Voxel, the revelation of the truth. That's the standard. And it's in all of those three cases. That's this circuit standard. We meet that standard on this pleading with all of the allegations that we've described.
So you're going over your time.
Thank you for allowing me a little bit more time.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Very interesting and novel case. Life Voxel, Virginia versus Life Voxel is submitted, and this session of the court is adjourned for today.
Thank you,
Your Honor. This court for this session stands adjourned.